This episode of Midori House was first broadcast on the 11th of April 2012 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House on Monocle 24, broadcasting live from Studio One here in London. I'm Christian Yeo. Coming up in the next hour, as Sudan announces a halt to all talks with South Sudan, we'll discuss what's been fueling the latest violence along the border. We'll also speak to the historian who thinks it's time for Germans to confront their grandparents about the truth of living through World War II.
They told me that they weren't so much into the Nazi ideology, but yeah, I learned that my grandmother was a member of the Nazi party.
It's Wednesday, so we'll check in with Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound. And what's more powerful, reasoning or moral instinct? We'll ask author Jonathan Haidt.
Bees make hives. It would be kind of strange to study bees without knowing that they live in hives. Humans make moral communities.
Plus, why Canada hasn't had a homegrown opera for 13 years. And we'll pick some songs from our global playlist for you to enjoy. All to come in the next hour on Midori House on Monocle 24. A packed show all to come. But before that, let's get the news now with Nick Kelly.
Monocle 24 News, I'm Nick Kelly. Syria has told international mediator Kofi Annan that it will halt all fighting by a dawn deadline on Thursday, but reserves the right to respond to any attack by armed terrorist groups. Annan, special envoy of the United Nations and the Arab League, said he would continue to work with the Syrian government and opposition to ensure complete implementation of his six-point peace plan.
If everyone respects it, I think by 6 o'clock, on Thursday the 12th, we should see much improved situation on the ground.
Syrian troops pummeled opposition neighborhoods in the city of Homs with heavy mortars today after Mr. Annan said Damascus promised to respect a ceasefire due to take effect in little more than 12 hours. The British Prime Minister David Cameron also warned that Syria faced civil war as the extended deadline for a ceasefire approached.
It is clear that the world needs to redouble its effort to stop the killing and intensify our support to those who oppose Assad's sabotage. This is a decisive moment. The United Nations Security Council now has a clear responsibility to throw its full weight behind Kofi Annan's plan and to insist that it is implemented.
A powerful 8.6 magnitude earthquake and a series of strong aftershocks struck off Indonesia today, sending people scurrying from buildings as far away as southern India, but there seemed little risk of a disastrous tsunami as in 2004. Indonesia said it was checking for damage and casualties, but remarkably, no such reports have been received for several hours after the quakes, including in Aceh, the closest province and the area decimated by the disaster 8 years ago. Thailand has since cancelled a tsunami warning in six of the country's Andaman coast provinces. People in the capital of Japan's southernmost prefecture of Okinawa were on heightened alert today as the countdown began before North Korea's long-range rocket was set to launch and fly over the islands. Japanese airlines are preparing to reroute flights ahead of the North Korean rocket launch to avoid no-fly zones, where authorities say rocket boosters may fall. Monocle's editor-in-chief Tyler Brule spoke on the briefing earlier.
Because of the launch, there's a lot of activity here right now. The two major Japanese airlines, ANA and JAL, are looking at rerouting some flights, adding extra fuel from tomorrow morning if the rocket launch goes off from North Korea. So the Japanese are taking this incredibly seriously.
Organisers of the Bahrain Grand Prix insist it will go ahead this month despite political unrest, bitter sectarian divisions and street violence. Last year's Formula One race was cancelled amid a harsh government crackdown on protests. Opposition activists calling for democratic reform want it called off again, condemning the glamorous big money international event as a tool of repression. Formula One world champion Sebastian Vettel made clear today he was ready to race in Bahrain next week should the sports decision makers stick to plans to hold the Grand Prix despite mounting protests.
The latest comment was that we are going to Bahrain to race there. I think if that's still the call, then I think it's safe enough to go, and then we should go there and race and not worry about something that is not our business.
And Greece will call a snap election for next month, opening a campaign that may produce no clear result and threaten implementation of the international bailout plan that saved the nation from bankruptcy. Prime Minister Lukas Papademos told the cabinet he would ask the president later today to set the parliamentary election for May the 6th, with a view to having a new government formed by May the 17th, according to a transcript of his comments released to reporters. Those are the top stories here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Nick. And as we were just hearing in Nick's bulletin there, the tsunami in Indonesia making the front pages today. Looking at the New Zealand Herald, a large photo of terrified residents in Bandar Aceh pouring onto the streets. The Herald says many were screaming, "Allahu Akbar, God is great." The tremors were felt in Singapore, Thailand, Bangladesh, Malaysia and India. Also recorded in New Zealand, although there was no real tremor felt by people on the ground, and there's no threat of a tsunami to New Zealand. They were quick to say that there. They have an interview with a survivor of the Christchurch earthquake who said it brought back memories. I'm sure it did. Another said, "It wasn't the strongest quake I felt, but it seemed to last forever." And just to the right of that, there's a story about Rena wine thieves lose job paying $2,300 a day. These are two divers working on the salvage of the Rena. They've been fired after helping themselves to wine inside one of the ship's containers. And just at the top of the Herald, they cover the US presidential race, or the widely predicted race, the choice, Obama versus Romney, after Rick Santorum pulled out of the Republican race. Those are the stories on the front of the New Zealand Herald. Let's get the world weather now with Thomas Schaffernacker.
The weather, in association with Kuoni Travel.
In Europe, early spring is turning out to be a chilly one, so very different from last month's heat. The Mediterranean is about to get stormy now as well as we head towards the end of the week. Heavy rain and high winds from Spain across Corsica and Sardinia to Italy and much of the Adriatic coast. Here's Thursday's City Outlook. In Madrid, cool with a mix of sun and rain, 13 degrees. In London, 13 with sun and thunder showers. Stockholm, 7 degrees, mostly cloudy. In Istanbul, it's 16 and partly cloudy. Now over to North America. Currently, across the Midwest of the US, it's looking pretty good. A lot of calm weather. In the Northeast, around New York State, say, it'll be getting brighter and warmer towards the end of the week. So pleasant weather if you're heading here. California, on the other hand, is soggy. Rain is a daily occurrence. The Pacific coast is actually one of the worst places to be. It's recently been pouring at LAX and windy too. Thursday's City Outlook, San Francisco, 12 degrees and rain. LA, 16, raining too. Chicago, 14 and sunny. In New York City, it's around 13 degrees with some sunshine. Now, around the world, let's start with South America. Sao Paulo, lots of thunder showers the next few days, around 27 here. In Santiago, the mid-20s, sunny. In Africa, in Cairo, it's 26 on Thursday, then Friday, a wind off the desert will send the temperatures up to 33 degrees. And if you're in Cape Town, it's a hot end to the week here on the way, 30 degrees Celsius. That's it. I'm meteorologist Thomas Schaffernacker here on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Tomas. 18.08 here in London, 5.02am if you're waking up in Auckland, New Zealand. You're with Midori House on Monocle 24.
Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Dette Monocle 24.
Esse Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
And a Monocle 24 highlight, yeah.
This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Monocle 24, you're welcome. Tämä on Monocle
24. The Monocle 24. This is Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
You're listening to Monocle 24.
This is Monocle 24.
Welcome back. Now, they gained independence from Sudan last July in what was hoped to be the end of hostilities. But on Tuesday, South Sudanese troops seized control of the Heglig oil field in the north. It follows weeks of heavy border fighting between the two countries. Heglig is usually recognised as being part of the north, something South Sudan disputes. Since Sudan announced the occupation, the African Union has waded in, demanding South Sudan withdraw its troops immediately. The latest clashes have fueled fears of a return to outright war. And joining me in the studio now is Dana Wilkins from the NGO Global Witness. Dana, thank you for coming in.
Yep.
Firstly, can South Sudan retain Heglig?
No, not for long. I mean, Heglig is a really strategic point for Sudan, and it's not one that Sudan's going to give up lightly. It's not just the area which produces 60,000 barrels a day of Sudan's oil, which is more than half of its daily production, but it's also the home of the central processing facility, which separates out all the oil from the water, and the start of its pipeline up to the refineries in the port.
And this is not the first time that South Sudan has intruded on this oil field. Most recently, 2 weeks ago, and then they vacated quite quickly. Why is that? Is their army no match for the north?
No, I think it's less than that. I think they, though South Sudan does claim rights to Heglig later on, they do recognize it that it's within South Sudan's current administrative territory. So it's not something that they can reasonably hold.
Why has the North, or Sudan, why has it publicly said Heglig's being occupied as we speak? Is it to garner international support?
Yeah, certainly. I mean, it's a huge blow, like I said before, because of the location of the oil field. So it's a huge blow to their economy, especially if the oil facilities are damaged. But it's also a serious political blow. And you're talking about a current sort of political context that's unstable within itself, not just in the region. Bashir's government is now facing like a massive political issue with this occupation.
What can the African nations do to stop this? Is there anything they can do? Are these just empty words?
I mean, all they can do is put pressure on South Sudan to withdraw its troops. But more than that, they also need to be putting pressure on Sudan to end the aerial bombardment of South Sudan, which preceded this occupation. So it's more than just South Sudan choosing to occupy it right now. It's a response. It's sort of this a perfect example of this ongoing eye for an eye situation, which has been just escalating. So it's gone from, you know, at the start, eye for an eye, and now they're going after each other's stomachs. As sort of crude an analogy as it is, it's actually quite appropriate because they're both so heavily dependent on the oil sector that to go after either facility, and Sudan has in the past gone after South Sudan's facilities, is a serious escalation.
Oil often the case, the center point of a lot of disputes. How much of a role did Heglig have in the civil war that we saw in Sudan before they broke apart?
Well, actually, you were seeing disputes around Heglig and Bambu are the two major oil fields in the area since before oil was even discovered in the 1970s. And of course, when oil was discovered, the tensions got worse in the area. And then when oil started being produced in 1999, it got even worse than that. And you saw a lot of forced displacement and a heavy militarization of the area, which has continued on through since 1999 to now. And it's this heavy militarization of the area combined with a lot of ethnic conflict and just easy access to small arms generally has led up to this point.
When they were formed as an independent country in July last year, was this predicted? Did people think this is likely to happen? Has the South ever accepted that Heglig is not its but the North's?
No, South Sudan's never formally accepted that that wasn't the case. I mean, there's...
So surely this was a problem just waiting to happen?
It was a problem waiting to happen, but it was also part of the ongoing negotiations between Sudan and South Sudan, because they'd previously agreed, though, of course, Khartoum had always claimed that Heglig was theirs, and they have occupied it and controlled it since before oil was discovered. Mm. This was a part of the what they call the Joint Technical Committee on Borders, was supposed to be hashing all this out in arbitration later on. So it's really, it wasn't inevitable, but as long as the negotiations continued and we're seeing next to no progress until the beginning of March, which of course has now been undermined, it was more and more likely that something like this would happen.
And now, moving forward, how can we get it back to negotiations and away from physical combat?
Well, the key will be a presidential summit. A lot of people are talking about security of the borders, but they, you know, they've been talking about that for years. The real answer is taking President Kiir and President al-Bashir and sitting them in a room together and forcing them with, you know, mediation by not just the EU or AU, but also members of the Troika, so the EU, or not the EU, sorry, the UK, US, and Norway, other key players like Ethiopia, in there to really put pressure on the parties to agree to certain things. And of course, oil will really be the gatekeeper issue here because it's so important to both countries.
What we've seen from African Union, not sitting on the fence at all, South Sudan get out, is that likely to be mirrored by other organisations? Perhaps if the UN spoke about it, are they all likely to side with Sudan?
Yes, and I mean, you could argue that that's not entirely fair here, but I think what everyone, all Sudan, South Sudan observers are fearing is that because this particular area is so critical to Sudan, that it will, you know, trigger just a complete deterioration of the situation, and Sudan will start taking measures beyond just, you know, sporadic aerial bombardment of the border areas, but something much, much larger than that, which will then very quickly deteriorate into war.
Specifically looking within the continent and the relationships that each side has with its neighbours, we're getting the consensus from the African Union as South Sudan must get out, but are there differing opinions within the continent? Presumably there are.
I mean, presumably, yes, because of historical ties. No one has come out openly and said, you know, South Sudan has the right to this area.
Right.
And I don't think anyone at this point will, because, like I said, they do recognize the risk of deterioration. And no one wants this to devolve back in, or deteriorate into war.
And from a viewpoint of the public in each country, is this very much us against them?
Very much so, yes. And it's been that way for a very long time. When South Sudan took Heglig 2 weeks ago, there were huge celebrations in Juba where the president spoke and all of the ministers gathered together and threw a party, like quite literally. And you know, we've retaken Heglig. It was this massive celebration. Whereas in Sudan, it was, you know, how could you let Heglig go? How could you let them take Heglig? And it, you know, sort of the divisions, the political divisions within both of the countries becomes even starker when you have a situation like this.
This seems like a skirmish, one after another after another. Will we now see a retaliation from the north and perhaps assets close to the border that are currently in the south's possession coming under attack?
Well, we've already seen it threatened. And actually, in the past, Sudan has bombed near to or at the oil facilities in South Sudan. Although I think Sudan is well aware of the fact that they are desperately hoping South Sudan will soon be restarting its oil production, which was shut down at the end of January as a result of this tension and conflict, so that they can then get a share of the oil revenues, which their economy needs. And it's been collapsing pretty much since independence because they have had no cut of that.
And what sort of time frame do you think we're looking at, Dana?
It's impossible to tell. I mean, the clashes like this are becoming more frequent. And like I said, the escalation seems almost inevitable as long as nothing's agreed to. So while I do think that South Sudan is likely to withdraw its forces from Heglig soon, it's very likely that we'll soon see another version of this happen soon.
Well, thank you very much for your insight today. Dana Wilkins from the NGO Global Witness. You're with Midori House on Molecule 24. Stay with us.
It started with a shop in London's Marylebone, and now Monocle also has stores in New York, Tokyo, Hong Kong, and a shop-in-shop in Osaka. And then there's the Monocle Cafe in Tokyo. Come in to find exclusive collaborations with brands we believe in, from Barena jackets to Porter luggage. Great for gifts, even better for personal treats. And if you're missing an issue from your Monocle archive, we can soon fix that. Visit monocle.com for store addresses and opening times. The Monocle Shop, carefully crafted design, proud of its provenance.
The Menu is Monocle's delectable food and drinks programme with me, Marcus Hippi. On the menu, you'll find out about delicious edibles and mouth-watering drinks. We traverse the globe in search of the pioneers, making a stir amongst the food connoisseurs. We hunt down the wonderful and, sometimes weird, tasty trends that are making a buzz in the food industry.
We've been sort of traveling and collecting stories and collecting projects. So one of the things we hope to do is to connect all these narratives across these different geographies.
Milan to Tokyo, Buenos Aires to Auckland. Each week we send our correspondents to the far-flung corners of the world. We pop into independent bakeries, butchers and wineries to find people passionate about what they make. From French cheese to Bulgarian wine, from Japanese chocolates to South African caterpillar snacks. The Menu premieres every Friday at 1900 hours GMT. Join us for a drink where everything is on the menu.
That's The Menu, premiering every Friday at 1900 hours UK time in association with Krug.
Welcome back. Let's have a song now. This is Mika Snow with Paddling Out. And that was Happy to You by the Swedish-Americans Mika Snow. It's from their new album, Happy to You. Now, in the decades which followed World War II, Germany was largely perceived as going through a process of public atonement. But our next guest has discovered that on an individual level, many people involved have downplayed the role they played under Hitler's rule, hiding the truth from their own families. Historian Moritz Pfeiffer decided to try and learn more about his grandparents' experiences. He heard their stories firsthand before checking them against other historical records from the time. His findings have just been published in a book in Germany, and I spoke to him earlier to hear about his family revelations. Moritz, firstly, can I ask why you decided to look into your grandparents' lives and their roles in the war?
Actually, there was just a personal interest first. I was studying history in a German university, and so I was always very interested in history, and so I had the possibility to talk to them, and at the end of their lives, in their last years, they had wish, I think, to talk about what they had experienced in their youth, and that was really interesting for me listening.
And up until that point, what did you know already about your grandparents and their roles?
I knew some stories that were in the family that everybody knew, that where, for example, my grandfather had fought in the war and when they had married, and this was what I already knew. But during this conversation, they told me some more details. But at the same time, I noticed that they were all the time trying to make sure that they had no responsibility for anything that happened, and that they had no possibility to do anything against the Nazis. And so I didn't believe them at all the stuff that they told me.
So you decided to verify a lot of what they told you. Was it difficult hearing a separate account of their roles and then, you know, building a picture of what actually happened?
Actually, when I checked the facts, when I tried to check what they had told me, it was really that there were a lot of things that they had told me, but they weren't true. Of course, it was kind of weird. On the other hand, I tried to understand why they didn't tell me. And so I think that maybe they already thought. But let me say it like this. When we talked about it, it was 60 years later. And during this 60 years, they had already, they read a lot about Nazi period, and they knew, of course, that there were a lot of crimes. And so they knew that they, you know, maybe they wanted to stay grandparents, the good grandparents in my eyes. And so they tried to tell me something. But at the same time, I think that these 60 years also made them believe that they had experienced the things exactly like they told me. However, they didn't.
And what was the reality, Moritz?
They told me that they weren't so much into the Nazi ideology, but I learned that my grandmother was a member of the Nazi Party, and she became a member of the Nazi Party when she was 19. She worked for administration of the Nazi Party in her hometown, and also my grandfather, who had told me that he didn't believe, for example, in the Goebbels speech of 43 about the total war. Then I read a letter he had written only some days after the speech, and he was absolutely fascinated by the speech. So there were a lot of contradictions.
As time went on and you asked them more about their experiences and you pieced together these other accounts from third parties, did their tone change? Did anything strike you about the way that they felt about what had happened in the past?
Actually, I think that they felt some kind of guilt for what they had believed, what they had done. But I think it was really, really difficult or impossible for them to articulate these feelings.
Although they built these stories to protect, you know, yourself and their other grandchildren, at the heart of it, you know, were they repentant or not? You said there was a sense of guilt. Was there still a sense that they supported the Nazi movement?
I think so, but I think it was really difficult and impossible for them to tell us about this. So I found some non-verbal hints of remorse, but that's really difficult and a quite complex process of psychological process of how they dealt with their past.
What made you think that other people of that generation were in the same scenario, and they'd built these constructs of what had happened, and if you just scratched beneath the surface, the truth was very different? You know, are you saying that what you learned about your grandparents can be applied to most of that generation?
I think actually scientific research that has done really proved that Germans had problems to deal their past in the first decades after the war, so especially the kids that were born after the war had problems to talk with their parents about it. And now the situation is that it was the same situation for me, that now this generation, the Nazi generation, of course, is dying. And now I got the impression they want to talk more. But on the other hand, today their grandsons and grandchildren, yeah, that's the fact that was proven by the research, they don't listen. They are not very interested in what the grandparents are telling, and that's a sad contradiction. And my opinion is that it's really helpful to talk with the older generation to try to understand what they were thinking, how did they behave against this totalitarian dictatorship, why maybe did they believe in this Nazi ideology. Or maybe, why did they resist? It's also possible. But this is very important for us, for our generation to know, of course, because I think it's what they suffered in the war and what they and the guilt they have. This is really important for us for today to know how we live in our democracy, and it's really important to accept that and to understand why it's very, very important how that today we have a European Union and great development.
And although it's different from discussing it with your own family, it must have been difficult for you to hear some of the things they said. But do you think it brought you closer together with them in the end, knowing the truth?
Yes, of course. This is absolutely what I believe, that it's talking with your family about what they experienced in the Nazi time doesn't mean to get in a great fight with them. In my case, at least, it was that it really brought us together, and it was really one important discussion.
And that was Moritz Pfeiffer talking to me earlier on. You're listening to Midori House.
LDN. TYO NYC MTV.
Now, in the next half hour on Midori House, we'll be checking in with Monocle's culture editor, asking how important moral instinct is to human behaviour, and discussing why Canadian opera isn't taking to the stage. But before that, here's Nick Kelly with the news headlines.
Thanks, Christian. Syrian troops pummeled opposition neighbourhoods in the city of Homs with heavy mortars today after peace envoy Kofi Annan said Damascus promised to respect a ceasefire due to take effect in little more than 12 hours. A powerful 8.6 magnitude earthquake and a series of strong aftershocks struck off Indonesia today, sending people scurrying from buildings as far away as southern India, but there seemed little risk of a disastrous tsunami as in 2004. People in the capital of Japan's southernmost prefecture of Okinawa were on heightened alert today as the countdown began before North Korea's long-range rocket was set to launch and fly over the islands. Greece will call a snap election for next month, opening a campaign that may produce no clear result and threaten implementation of the international bailout plan that saved the nation from bankruptcy. Myanmar's opposition leader Aung San Suu Kyi held rare talks with President Thein Sein today ahead of a parliament debut that her party threatened to delay unless an oath taken by lawmakers was changed. Nine workers trapped inside a mine in southern Peru were rescued and brought to daylight earlier today after spending almost a week underground. The men have been stuck about 200 metres below ground since the informal copper and gold mine partially collapsed on Thursday. President-elect Vladimir Putin has called NATO a relic of the Cold War, but said he supported letting the alliance use a Russian airport as a supply hub in support of its mission in Afghanistan. Tunisia's Islamist-led government, in a major climb down today, reversed a ban on protests in the capital's central thoroughfare after an outcry over a violent police crackdown on a demonstration there this week. And Ahmed Ben Bella, Algeria's first president after the country became independent from France half a century ago, has died following an illness. He was 96. Those are the top stories on Monocle 24.
Thank you, Nick. You're listening to Midori House, and I'm Christian Yeo. Well, it's Wednesday, which means it's time for our weekly dose of in-house culture here on Midori House. I'm joined in the studio by Monocle's culture editor, Robert Bound. How are you, sir?
I'm very well, Christian. You rolled your eyes slightly when you said that, as if you didn't believe it yourself.
I haven't seen you for a while, that's why. It's been too long.
Oh, come on, it's all right. We're in here. It smells like a new car in here today.
It might be my aftershave.
Is that right?
I didn't want it smelling like
what
new
is it?
Car.
Is it Eau de Focus?
I'll tell you later.
Are you feeling focused?
Now I am.
You're smelling focused.
It's the smell of cheap success. No, there we go.
Good gracious.
What have you been doing? Now, we're going to talk about Ai Weiwei because his gallery is now going to Milan. And you've seen the work.
Well, I've seen some of the work. This is the Listen Gallery, an august contemporary gallery from London. Spread its wings and it's got a space in Milan, which opened, I think, in last October.
Right.
Around the time that Frieze sort of finished in London, they opened their space there. And this is Ai Weiwei, who's obviously one of their artists. And this stuff that this isn't a travelling show. This isn't the stuff that he showed at their gallery in London. It's a new take on some of his older works,
which have been given a bit of
good press recently. I guess we were talking off air about these security cameras that he's had installed in his own studio.
Yes, and we were arguing whether this is more of the story. I mean, it's marking a year on, really, isn't it? It's a bit tongue-in-cheek as well for all his fans who are worried about him being taken.
It's a great piece of art, I think. You know,
I'm trying to log on now, but it's not.
It's been taken down by the authorities. Not the Monocle authorities, Christian. It's not like there's... No one's watching you, I don't think.
Well, if only they had webcams here, I tell you.
He basically is a sort of palliative or and a bit of a piss take of the Chinese authorities. Installed 15 webcams in his own studio, installed a number of webcams in his own studio, which were put online for everyone to see. So his fans obviously logged on to see what artwork he was doing and what his daily life is like, because he lives there and sleeps there most of the time as well as the authorities. And they thought we don't need this amount of control over Mr. A, and told him to take them down. And he's like, well, what gives? Because apparently there are security cameras put up by the authorities all around his studio. So it's kind of a...
They're watching him, but the public aren't allowed to.
Exactly.
Doesn't it shatter the illusion, though, of an artist? There's a mystique about artists that you don't want to break when you're seeing them do mundane things all the time.
Well, I suppose so, but I think, you know, kind of like considering he's been sort of like detained under sort of house arrest and then house arrest, I suppose it's nice to kind of say that my life is an open book.
Yes, so there we are. An artist of Big Brother proportions.
Possibly.
Yes.
Exactly.
So it's not the same stuff that you saw in London then?
So no. This is one. Well, in fact, funny enough, one of the works he was showing in London last year during the Listen show was this beautiful ceramic sculpture of a big CCTV camera. But this is other stuff. A lot of obviously you remember the sunflower seeds that filled the turbine hall. Turbine hall.
I'm looking at.
I don't know why I've gone West Country on everyone.
No,
there.
Don't worry, you're fine. I'm cheating hall. Here.
You've got some pictures.
Here.
You've Google imaged
What's
it.
What's he done with the bicycles there?
I don't know. Is that part of the show?
I don't know. Somebody's put fake. Okay, maybe not.
Okay, maybe not.
I need your guidance here.
But you know, anyway, these sunflower seeds weren't sunflower seeds. They were things that were individually made by Chinese craftsmen or indentured labourers or whatever. There's obviously a discussion about what sort of people make these kind of minute things that are almost like mass-produced products. So he always riffs on, he man makes things that are things of nature. So in this show, he's got an oil slick, which he sort of made out of ceramics, and he's made watermelons, which are these sort of slightly kind of Roy Lichtenstein fake kind of almost cartoony watermelons, but they're sort of beautifully made. And he did a big working tour of the province of China called Jingzhen, which is the place that makes all these ceramics, which has this, you know, these great history of Ming vases and all this sort of ancient sort of Chinese ceramics. So he's sort of riffing on that. So that's a lot of the show. And then of course a lot of the show is sort of, you know, about helped by the PR of this this camera stuff.
Yeah, is that level of PR and his newfound popularity, widening popularity because of what's happened to him, is that affecting his work? Now you're comparing old with new.
Well, I kind of think so. I think, you know, he's done a lot of his work in the public eye, and a lot of it's been about being in the public eye. A lot of it's been about surveillance, and a lot of it's about being watched. So I don't feel that it's not about wanting to be famous. He's not a rock star artist like the other guy that's got a big show on in London right now, which is perfectly fine as well. He's not a rock star artist.
They'll have to Google to find out who.
I don't know who you might find there. Actually, you'll probably find Ronnie Wood because I think he paints.
He looks a bit like the skull.
Well, there you go, exactly.
What else is in your diary then this week?
So that's that. And I also wanted to play a new record.
I
played a track from this. I have played a track from this on the radio, on Monocle 24 before.
Okay.
This is Amanda Mayer. She's new. Look at the cover. Amanda Hare, I could almost say. She's 18. She's Swedish. She's quite hot, and she's a very good singer. I'm looking at the press release, and I don't want to read out what someone else has written about a record, right? But I think I reviewed this in the magazine that's just coming out for Monocle. But Pop Justice, the website, has called this album a non-stop amazathon. And I think I need to kind of buck up my writing, actually.
You need to introduce some new words, Rob.
So, exactly. So from that, and it's just called Amanda Mayer by Amanda Mayer, this is Doubt, a non-stop amazathon.
Thank you as always, Rob.
Cheers, Christian.
After this short break on Midori House, we'll be talking to the author who thinks our moral compasses could be in danger of becoming too polarised. So stay with us.
Every Saturday on The Review, Monocle's editors ditch their jackets and unbutton their top buttons for a cosy weekend look at what's selling at bookshops from Buenos Aires to Brisbane.
This store was insanely busy. It was incredible. So if you had walked in on that day from outer space, you would never have had any clue that people weren't passionately in love with physical books.
A survey of the Global Newsstand, some fine tracks chosen by a great music guest, and lots of good conversation. Join us every Saturday at midday London time. And remember, this show is best enjoyed with coffee while camped out on your sofa.
It's 1842 here at Midori House. Now, morality is a card played time and time again the world over, whether it be rebellion to the Saudi Arabian Mutawa or the revolving debate over abortion in the US. Opposing moral values spark disagreement and sometimes anger in most, if not all, countries and faiths. But is morality, intuition and righteousness sculpted by our surroundings, or does it run through our veins? Well, I spoke to Jonathan Haidt, the author of The Righteous Mind, to find out.
Well, morality is a basic fact about our species. Bees make hives. It would be kind of strange to study bees without knowing that they live in hives. Humans make moral communities. And if we didn't have moral communities, we would be like the other animals out there trying just to survive. Morality is the amazing new ability that we got at some point in the last half million years when our ancestors began constructing symbolic communities, talking about things. We got language during this time, and most importantly, holding each other to various expectations and norms. We are the descendants of the people who did this well, and well means they were able to bind themselves into communities that could work together, cooperate, and outcompete other communities.
So a successful morality is ingrained in all of us, in our ancestors and through evolution. It's not just physical attributes that are passed down the line, but in fact morality as well.
Well, that's right. But I wouldn't say that the morality is ingrained in us. What's ingrained in us is a capacity to respond emotionally to different kinds of events. So just as we have these innate taste buds in our mouths, and these taste buds make it possible for each culture to have a cuisine, but the cuisine is not innate. In the same way, these moral taste buds are innate. We all dislike seeing cruelty and violence, cheating, oppression, betrayal, all of these things. But our cultures construct moralities, and these moralities can change in just a generation or two.
You illustrate an interesting difference between, and a battle within, between reasoning and morality. And you believe morality is the far stronger beast, and reasoning can only guide morality in a slight direction, but overall your morality is what drives you as a person.
Well, I would just change the word morality to intuition or moral intuition. So my early research, so I'm a social psychologist. That means I do experiments in the lab and I do interviews. And my early research was on how people make moral judgments about situations where somebody does something that's maybe disturbing, but it doesn't hurt anyone. So a woman who uses her American flag to clean her toilet, she's out of rags and she cuts it up, or a family that eats its pet dog after the dog was killed by a car. Most people say this is wrong, and then I would press them to say why, and they would often sort of scratch their head. And first they'd say, well, you know, they'll get sick if they eat dog meat. And I'd say, well, no, but it's cooked. There's no germs. They would often scratch their head and say, well, I don't know. It just seems weird and wrong. So this shows that moral intuitions are often separable from reasoning. And what I found in later research is that the reasoning is a totally separate process. You have to see it as if it's aesthetic judgment. When you see a painting, somebody says, do you like it? Do you weigh the pros and cons and then come to a verdict? Or do you have a snap judgment? And then you search for reasons afterwards. That's the way the mind works. And that's the way our moral minds work.
And it doesn't matter whether it's a religious figure that's at the heart of it or whether it's a political issue at the heart of it. Will we ever reach a resolution, which is what many people always hope for? Or will we always continue as a race, as a species, to always have disagreements and always have this battle and debate?
We will always have disagreements and debate and battle. And if kept within certain parameters, that is a good thing. One of the themes of my book and one of the themes of research in psychology these days is that each of us is so biased in our thinking, we can't possibly see the whole truth. And then we circle around with other people that believe as we do. And so let's just take in the United States, for example, people on the left are very sensitive about issues of, say, inequality and the need to extend benefits. But that tends to bust the bank, hand out entitlements, and do things that end up weakening the very underclass that you're trying to serve. They only see part of the picture. On the right, they see the part that the left doesn't see, but then they're blind to the pernicious effects of unchecked capitalism. So the way I've come to see left and right is really is like yin and yang. You need both. And the tension between them is productive. Now, what happens is that sometimes it escalates from, let's say, intramural sports competitions, which can be quite friendly or at least not hostile, into, I guess, what you guys have here, football hooliganism. And that's what we have in the American Congress right now, it seems. So my goal is not world peace. It is not world agreement. That's never going to happen. My goal is just to tone down the volume, tone down the demonizing, so that our disagreements can be more civil.
If this is ingrained, this yin and yang aspect and this toing and froing, this warring of minds, what is the natural end point? Is it destruction or is it compromise?
Well, it's living with the fact that there will never be a balance or end point. Mm. I mean, you know, there's this battle between day and night. Well, when does it stop? Will it ever be just dawn forever? You know, this is just the way life is. Many of our systems are what's called sometimes a cybernetic system. You need a kind of a process pushing one way, a process pushing another, and they shift around. And that's a fairly adaptive or effective way of responding as the environment changes.
When you write a book like this, who do you have in mind as your reader? Is it somebody, a decision maker in politics? Is it a fellow psychologist? Who do you think about when you're discussing your thoughts in a book like this?
A lot of my writing comes out of my many years teaching Psych 101, the introductory psychology course at the University of Virginia. And when I first taught that, a lecture class to 350 18-year-olds, I would be thinking about the lecture for that day, and I'd notice myself in the kitchen making breakfast and saying, you take the eggs and you break them carefully, you know, just trying to say everything in the clearest possible way. And so my main audience, I guess, is just kind of an intelligent, educated audience. I think moral psychology is the most fascinating topic there could be, and I want to explain that. Now, I suppose as I go on in the book, there is a particular audience that I do have in mind, and it is basically liberal intellectuals, I suppose. I am working harder in the book to convince them that conservatives are not stupid and crazy than I am to convince conservatives that liberals are not. Well, they don't think they're stupid. The right thinks that liberals are just have loose morals and are smug and self-righteous.
And you would say that both sides, liberals and conservatives, have an equal number of people who have strong reasoning skills. Neither side has a particular strength in one or the other. It's not fair to say conservatives are more knee-jerk and less reasonable than liberals. It's very much equal because it's genetic.
Well, it's not so much that it's genetic. There are some small differences that predispose people to going left or right. And while it is true that if you look at social liberals versus social conservatives, the research shows that there is a higher degree of openness to experience, tolerance of ambiguity, and even integrative complexity of reasoning on the left than the right. So there is some of that. And this is why liberals tend to be attracted to the academy, to journalism. There are certain fields in which liberals predominate. So there is but those differences are relatively small. What happens, though, is that each group then only talks to others in its group. And so people on the left can end up being quite blind and quite closed to ideas because they're simply not challenged by ideas on the right. In America, at least, if you're conservative, you can't reach the age of 30 without having encountered a lot of liberal ideas. But I never really met a conservative or encountered a conservative idea till I was 40, and I was teaching a course on political psychology. So there are some ways in which I think some of the best thinking now in America, at least, is by intellectuals who are center-right, because they really have been challenged their whole lives.
One last question for you, Jonathan. This must be a very good time for you in terms of monitoring and assessing what's going on in the US with the election. More than ever in the last 5 years, the US seems polarized, as do most countries at election time. Mm-hmm. What are you gleaning from it this time around? Mm-hmm.
Well, I do feel as though, in a sense, I'm on the Titanic. The country is going down, but at least I've been given a chair at the captain's table. It is fun to at least be able to analyze the events as they're happening, I suppose. Parties are usually coalitions. And what we have in America for the first time in our history is that the parties aren't so much coalitions of interest groups anymore. For the first time, it is a perfect sorting of left versus right, liberals in one party, conservatives in another. Now, in the UK, you're kind of mixed up, and that's a good thing. You know, your conservative party does some progressive things, and your Labour Party does some less progressive. So, but that's actually healthy. It's a little confusing, but it's a little healthy because it means that the people in the two parties are not alien species. In America now, for the first time in our history, there are no Republicans in Congress who are as liberal as the most conservative Democrat. In other words, there's no overlap, and that makes it very difficult for them to do bipartisan initiatives or even to like each other. They don't even meet each other anymore.
And would you like to see that change? Is that
yes? Yeah, that's one of the big problems. I was on a panel with David Brooks, the New York Times columnist, a few weeks ago, and he said one of the big problems in Washington is the decline of bourbon. They used to drink together. They used to live in Washington. They would attend the same dinner parties, and they would drink together. And that's very humanizing. That makes it possible to listen to each other. And that no longer happens. The two parties, they don't live in Washington. They fly in on Monday night or Tuesday morning. They're there for 2 or 3 days to fight in their bunkers, and then they fly away. So there is no more human connection. And without a human connection, it's very hard for us to just listen to each other because our reasoning is so weak. Our reasoning is so pushed around by our emotions and our team memberships.
The answer is bourbon.
Bourbon and enough time to enjoy it and each other, yes.
And that was Jonathan High talking to me earlier on. Now, can you name a Canadian opera? If the answer is no, you might not be alone. It's been 13 years since a homegrown libretto was commissioned, and the Canadian opera community is starting to wonder whether it might be time for one. But what financial hurdles might stand in their way, and what Canadian stories would actually make for good inspiration? Well, joining me now on the line is Kate Taylor, the feature writer for Canada's Globe and Mail newspaper, and I'm also joined in the studio by Canadian arts journalist Leah McLaren. Leah, firstly, how are you? Thank you for coming in.
Thank you.
And Kate, if I can ask you firstly, why hasn't Canada not seen an opera for 13 years?
Well, Canadian opera, of course, would be a new opera, and any opera company, whether they're in New York or Paris or Toronto, finds their audiences, of course, prefer 19th century operas. They prefer the classic repertoire, the Puccinis and the Verdis. So Canadian opera is a new opera, so that's the first kind of hurdle against it. And then, of course, you're drawing in Canada from a fairly small pool of composers who are interested in composing operatic music, and you've got to get the money together for it at a time when, of course, arts grants are shrinking, not growing, and Canadian arts companies like the Canadian Opera Company are, of course, less heavily subsidized by governments to begin with than their, you know, sister organizations in the UK or in Europe.
Has much of the talent moved overseas, would you say?
Well, if you mean the challenge of making new opera, I think that's a challenge across North America. I mean, I think in the U.S. there's the same issue, right? It's that you're doing Italian opera, you're doing French opera, you're not often doing American opera. And I think American companies recognize the challenge and also rise to it. So I think it's kind of a new music challenge to some extent. I think on the arts front, what we hear anyway from Europe is that European companies are starting to face the same kind of confrontation with government and need to, you know, justify what they do to government that Canadian arts groups have always had to work with.
Leah, we were just discussing, you know, the challenges faced by a country with less cultural heritage. What sort of stories would make for good opera in Canada's history?
Well, I was trying to think about this on the taxi ride over, and Canada's not a particularly operatic nation, or at least we don't think of ourselves that way. We sort of define ourselves as not being melodramatic and operatic. Not that we don't love opera.
You enjoy it as spectators.
And have fine opera companies. Yes, exactly. But thinking maybe, you know, because what you need in this case is not just new material, but you also need new benefactors, that once Conrad Black sort of, you know, gets through his legal troubles and bounces back, maybe he and his wife are huge patrons of the arts and opera lovers. Maybe they could actually commission an opera about their lives. And it could even be a co-production with Britain.
And I think the key is now modern stories that captivate perhaps a new generation of audiences. In terms of the wider cultural landscape in Canada now, is it embracing the modern age for the lack of a great vast historical catalogue to draw on like Europe can?
Well, I mean, it's a tricky one. I mean, Canada, as Kate states in her brilliant piece, of course, for the world of opera, embracing the modern world is not really necessarily what the patrons want. And for good reason, there's a lot of great opera that already exists. Canada, though, does have a very vibrant arts community and is very forward-looking. But opera is, I think, a different sort of realm. You know, I mean, I recently did stories on the ROM at the Royal Ontario Museum and the Art Gallery of Ontario, both of which have amped up their fundraising in recent years and have tons of money being poured into them. But the ROM doesn't ever need to put on shows of Canadian antiquities because there are none and they don't have to create any. And the AGO, if they do put on a Canadian show of art, the art is already there. So it's a very tricky thing, the world of opera.
Kate, if I can go back to you and ask, you know, looking at, you know, your history as a country, is that against Canada's chances of creating new opera compared with other continents, other parts of the world?
Oh, I don't think it's really a question of finding a Canadian story. I mean, you're really talking about Canadian composition. There are, for instance, several people in Toronto right now with a small group called Tapestry New Opera who are working on an opera which we would consider a Canadian opera because the librettist is Canadian and the composer is Canadian. The subject is sexual slavery in Eastern Europe in the 20th century. So, you know, I don't think we have some narrow definition of Canadian where we're saying, well, it's got to have canoes and it's got to have beavers. If you want Canadian content, that is a very Canadian story. There was an opera created for Centennial Year in 1967 about Louis Riel, the great rebel or hero, depending on your point of view, who was hanged by the government around the time of Confederation. So, and came out of the Métis community in Manitoba. So, he's a hero to Aboriginal people in Canada.
Kate, I have to leave it there. I'm ever so sorry to cut you short there. Thank you ever so much for giving us your insight on that, Kate Taylor, and also to Leah McLaren. We've run out of time today for Midori House. The show was produced by Katie Bilboa, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco, and our studio managers were Toby Hammond and Sam Impey. Stay with us at 2200 hours London time. Emma Nelson and Andrew Muller will be back with The Daily.